Welcome to the Label Podcast, a show about disability, illness, and difference. I'm Lucy.
And I'm Alice.
And that's Lola. Lives differently, kaleidoscope identity, and this is who I'm meant to be. I'm just labeled me. I'm just labeled me.
Don't forget, in this episode, I might swear, Lucy might cry, and you can check out details of the trigger warnings on our website. I should bring my microphone for today.
It's a fucking good start. Hi, everyone.
This is what happens when we record on a Sunday. It's the Labeled Podcast. I'm sure you guys are used to our chaos, but for those of you who are new, we are a podcast about disability, illness, and difference, and we are in the middle of our LGBTQIA plus pride series, where we are talking to people who identify within the LGBTQ plus community who also have a disability or health difference. With me, as usual this week, is Lucy Wood.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, you're right.
I'm okay. I'm feeling a little bit embarrassed for just giving you shit for knocking your microphone over when my microphone was still 2 feet away.
I have spazzy hands. That's what my excuse is. What is yours?
It was outside of my field of vision. That's
okay,
what it was.
Fair enough,
that's
we'll let you off.
That is my excuse and I'm fucking sticking to it.
Disability cards both played there. Congratulations.
Yes, very much so. What have you been up to, Luz?
What have I been up to? Not really. Work. My lift is being installed this week. So it is the calm before the storm. We're tidying the stairs, making sure there's enough space because I'm having a new lift installed in my house this week. So I've got the week off work, but can't really do anything with it because of noise and builders being needed to supervise. So, you know, can't go anywhere.
You are going to stay in a luxury hotel.
Yeah, I'm going to stay at the Premier and down the road so that I can have a shower and a proper bath because I'm not sleeping on the sofa and I often stink if left unattended for too long. So I'm going to stay in Costa del Rugeley, opposite a McDonald's, for 3 nights. But coming home during the day, you see?
Yeah.
Yeah. My mum isn't looking forward to stopping in a Premier Inn because she says, I snore and I don't know what to do with my arms in bed. So, you know. good luck, everybody.
Yeah. You guys may hear chuckling away in the background. Our guest today, everybody give a warm welcome to my friend Lee, our guest this week. Lee, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I can do. I'm Lee. I'm a 31-year-old gay man. I'm a drama teacher at a high school in Leicestershire, and I'm HIV positive.
Thank you very much for coming on, Lee. Really excited to have you on. I'm looking forward to sort of hearing some of Lee's stories. I have some shocking stories about my hen night, which Lee came on with me. It's definitely going to be some photos to share.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me everything, Lee.
I mean, I think the one big thing that really stands out is the picture of Lee and I. I think Lee is doing me from behind with an inflatable penis.
Okay.
I thought that was what everyone did on him.
Yeah. So I'm sure I can dig that photo out and put it all over social media. I have no shame. So.
Yeah, you should. I'm down for it.
Exactly.
You're going to have to pixelate your face out for like work purposes. Like, don't know who this man is.
Is that worse? That I don't know who that man
the
is.
Eyes.
Yeah. Redacted.
Yeah, that thing where everyone knows who it is, but you've just put the most minimum amount of sex chip in.
Yeah. We've not got the budget for like whole pixel eight tracers.
No, we are not a high budget, highfalutin show here.
No.
So Lee, we decided to gather some people together for our to do a show about LGBTQ pride and, you know, health difference. And of course, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of the people who exist outside of the gay and disabled communities, first kind of thing that they think of when they think of disability and homosexuality is obviously HIV, particularly, you know, those the crisis in the 80s. And I always think of the lovely films like Philadelphia, which are, you know, wonderful depictions of the HIV and AIDS experience. And obviously, I think, you know, the AIDS and HIV experience is very different now in 2022 than it was in the late 80s, early 90s. But I don't know if you want to just sort of share a little bit about your sort of experience.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of kind of the way that HIV impacts people's lives now in comparison to like the crisis in the 80s. It's completely different. It's so much more manageable, but the stigma from the 80s is still 100% there, and it isn't shifting, and it's really, really frustrating. So I knew very, very little about HIV growing up. Like anyone that's kind of in our age bracket, I think, has that same thing, because I'm an educator as well. I'm going to kind of segue a little bit here, but the whole thing where schools weren't allowed to talk about sexuality. And so that meant that schools didn't really teach about HIV other than the fact that it existed. And if you got it, you died. And that was it. Mm. That was kind of what you get taught is it's the one STD you can never get rid of, is there forever, and you end up dying. And that was it, glazed over. And obviously my parents lived through the 80s. And so anything that I hear from them was all the remnants of that 80s crisis. And I didn't do any research myself because as a gay man, anal sex isn't really kind of part of what I'm about. So I didn't think I was really at any risk either. And so then as my kind of development, as you know, my sexual development as a gay man kind of started to progress, and I started to be a little bit more experimental in what I was doing sexually, I managed to contract HIV the first time I had anal sex. It was the most unfortunate experience, I think, ever. And so I, in terms of kind of diagnosis, I noticed that I was like consistently sick, like with a cold or a sore throat, or there was something wrong with me consistently for about 3 months. My diet had meant that I was getting really bad digestion issues. I was constantly in and out of the toilet. I was like, normally I'm a really solid sleeper, and I was having to wake up in the night and go to the toilet two or three times, and it was always quite unpleasant. And my face started to break out. I started to get quite bad, like rosacea in my cheeks. And then that started to kind of become acne as time went on as well. And so I went to the doctor, and they did a load of tests, and kind of, it was only eventually when they sent me for blood tests. And then the doctor said, as they do, we'll only call you if something's wrong, which is a terrible thing to say. I don't know why.
Cause it's like, you don't think all the doctors calling, this is going to be good news.
Exactly. So yeah. I'm sat there, you know, balls deep in an assessment. And I get a phone call. So I'm sat at my computer, and then my phone rings, and it's like 5 to 6. And it's the doctor's, and I'm like, the doctor closes at 6. So I answer it, and he's like, hi Lee, can you pop down to the clinic?
Like, he's not like 3 weeks.
That's surprise.
It. Like, yeah. 3 weeks. Not 3 weeks on Thursday. Like now.
No.
Yeah. Immediately.
And I'm like, yeah, when do you want me to come? And he's like, yeah, now. And I'm like, but you close in 5 minutes. He's like, yeah. So if you could come in through the door in the car park, that'd be great. And I'm like, this is dodgy as fuck. What is this? so off I go. Like, it's a 20-minute walk to the doctor's, and that 20-minute walk is
horrific.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Because now, obviously, you know, I'm blow my own horn here, but I'm quite a smart guy, and so I'm already thinking, I've twigged that my immune system is shot. And so in the back of my brain somewhere, the HIV thing is playing, you know,
yeah.
It's there mm-hmm. and it's going, that's what this is, that's what this is, that's what this is. And I'm like, I have had sex one time. Like, come on, this can't, this can't possibly be a thing. So I get to the doctor's completely deserted. I go into the car park and the doctor is there with the reception staff waiting for me. So I go in, they lock the door behind me.
They lock the door. I'd be like,
well, yeah, what? I know.
This is some horror film, this.
It was terrifying.
Yeah.
And I sit in the doctor's and so the receptionist obviously goes back to the reception desk. So I'm there in the doctor's office just with him. And he's fantastic. You know, he's like, okay, so your blood results are back and your HIV test has come back positive. And he said it just like that at that pace. So my brain didn't, you know, it takes a moment
for
my brain to kind of go, wait, what the fuck did he just say? and first instinct straight off was denial. I was 100% certain the doctor was lying. He wanted to ruin my life. Right there at the back was, you're going to die now. You know, like that's what's there, because the only education I had was the stigma from the 80s, the stuff that I learned from a school that's not allowed to talk about sexuality, and my parents who went through the AIDS crisis of everyone dying in the 80s, you know. And my parents haven't really engaged with the LGBT community growing up. My mum, I think, she started to twig. Probably, I didn't come out till I was 18, till I came to university. So my mum started to twig, I think, when I was in my teens. I was always not particularly laddish. And I think dad always seemed a bit disappointed. Mine and my dad's relationship's a little bit strained. Mum and dad are still together. And I do still, you know, see them. But mine and my dad's relationship, we were never really close. He was always a lot closer to my sister, I think, because she fitted, he's very traditional. And she fits the criteria of what a little girl should have been. And I didn't really fit the criteria of what a little boy should have been. I took an interest in my academics and I did, you know, I was doing well at school and I didn't like sport and I was a little bit outgoing and I liked drama and all of these things that my dad couldn't relate to. So I think he didn't know how to interact with me. And so actually I grew up in a household that was a little bit homophobic, actually. So, you know, there were times where my dad would say to me, you know, we'd be watching the telly and it was about the end of the 90s and the start of the 2000s when all of the kind of gay storylines started coming out in the soaps, which is obviously television that's designed for people like my dad. So, you know, he's watching that and he turns to me and he's like, if you ever bring a boy home, Lee, you'll be out. And mum was like, I don't mind if you bring a boy home, Lee, as long as you're not a drug dealer. So yeah. Those are kind of... Those were my two criteria.
A lesser of the two evils.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I had two life choices I was supposed to avoid. whoops, I still chose one of them. I'm sat there in the doctor's surgery, got that thought at the back of my brain, denying everything the doctor's telling me he's wrong. And I physically lose my shit. Now, I'm incredibly, I'm excitable as a person, I'm emotive, but I'm 100% a pacifist. Like, I don't believe in violence at all.
No.
And I trashed this doctor's room. Like, I went into a rage. And this doctor, honest to God, he was brilliant. He just sat there. He just sat there and let it happen. And then after I couldn't do anything else, I couldn't knock anything else off the surfaces. I couldn't do anything else. And I just sat down. He just went, are you done? And I was like, yeah, I think so. I'm really sorry. And he was like, it's okay. Let's talk about it, you know? And so the next day I had to go to the hospital and have a load of bloods taken. They talked to me a little bit more about that. He said, you know, things have come on a long way. You're essentially going to live a really, really normal life. It's not anything to worry about. It's not the same way that it was. And you hear it and you go, okay, that is a little bit reassuring. But there's still the half of your brain that says,
yeah,
but you're not living it, so you don't really know. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've got that.
You know, in a funny way, with my experience with my disability, that I get that very much.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. It's the same thing for me as well. The same, you know, they say, you know, this is what it's going to be like. You're going to be absolutely fine. And you think, yeah, but you're not the one that's living with.
Exactly. And you're not the one who has to deal with the, like, frustrations and you know, the impotencies that you, when you can't do something even if you really, really want to and you're really trying, or when you're, if something hurts and you can't stop it, you know, things like that. It's that, is that kind of exactly that Yeah. All right. Like, you come back to me when you've got this.
Yeah.
But like weighing up what you can and can't do because of energy levels and pain levels the next day, because you think this is going to hurt in the morning, but I've got to do this, that kind of thing. You're like, yeah, that's completely normal. That's what everybody else does.
I think what was really weird as well, and really kind of interesting to think about, is that the doctor, in order to try and kind of equivalate this, he said it's much easier living with HIV now than it is living with something like diabetes. And so he compared those two conditions against each other, which I don't think until today, I don't think I've ever reflected on how that's kind of bad, right? Kind of bad. So, but I mean, again, I still took that point on, and obviously the memory's there. So obviously it had some sort of impact. I mean, the irony being the tablets that they eventually then put me on for HIV have a link to causing diabetes anyway. No, it swings and roundabout, and I'm literally due to go to the hospital next week because of a diabetes scare. So this is great. So that was a thing.
Thank you so much.
But you know, I've had 10 years of my life where it's been easier than it will be for the next however many years. So So that was kind of, in terms of kind of the medical diagnosis, that was that. The problem, so then he was like, oh, here's my mobile number. If you need me between now and then at any time, you can contact me. So that was really awesome as well. And then he was like, have you got somewhere to go? And truth be told, I didn't. I didn't have anywhere to go. I could have gone home. My best mate was there, but my best mate at the time was on oddball and not someone that I felt like I could immediately talk to about this. But when someone says to you, have you got somewhere to go, and you just don't want to be sat in their room anymore, you're going to say yes, because you don't want to be sat in their room anymore. I was saying anything I could to get the fuck out of there. So I was like, yeah, course. And he was like, okay, and you're going to be all right getting there. Do you need me to call you a taxi? And I was like, no, it's fine. I can get there. So I left the doctor's surgery. They unlocked the door and I went back out into the car park. And I walked to work. By default, I didn't know what else to do. I didn't want to go home to where there was, you know, one person. I wanted to be somewhere that was completely detached from everything. So I was working at the theatre in Leicester at the time. I'd been working there for 4 years. So I walked to work, and outside work, I saw someone that I was well acquainted with, but I wouldn't really consider them a friend. But a gay man and a gay older man. He was like, hi Lee, are you all right? And I was like, no, actually. And he stopped and he's like, what's the matter? Like, he was obviously leaving work to go home, but he stopped. And I was just like, I've just come back from the doctors, and I'm HIV positive. And that was where the tears came. And he was like, okay, come with me. So he took me in to work. Found the manager that was on shift. Now I was a team of the front of house managers, so they knew who I was. He was like, Lee needs somewhere to go. So they took me to this little like supply room. I was sat there. So the main reason that I'd gone to work is I think because the person, like, I'd had sex one time. Where this had come from was immediately apparent to me. And I know that the guy that I'd slept with, like, it wasn't like a foolish one night stand. That wasn't it. I'd been seeing this guy for a while. We'd had conversations about if we were, you know, if we were clean, if we'd had sexual health screenings, blah, 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 blah. We'd had all of that conversation. Because I, you know, I'm not stupid. So we'd done all of that. And the fact of the matter is, this guy had lied to me. That's the fact of the matter. But at that point, that wasn't what I was thinking, because actually I was thinking, this guy has an illness that he doesn't know about. And I now need to tell him, even though he's the fucker that gave it to me in the first place. You know what I mean? So it's such a complex state of being, because that thing that the doctor was trained for, to have that conversation with me, is then left to me to tell this other guy. And that's fucking horrible, like so bad. So he was working on a show. And by the time I got to the doctors, by the time I got to the theater, it was 7 o'clock and the show went up at 7:45. And there was no way I could tell him before the show. That would have been awful. Yeah. So I had to sit in that room for 3 hours because I couldn't go home. I didn't know what else to do. So I sat in that room and waited to tell him after the show, and me and him had kind of fallen out a little bit. So he didn't really want to talk to me, and I had to get other members of staff at Curve to go and say, no, you seriously, you need to speak to him. So while I was in that room, I called another one of my best friends who I now live with. She's still really, really dear to me. I called her, and I have a track record in my life of being incredibly unlucky. And genuinely, when I told her and her partner that this had happened, and this is the kind of friendship we have, she was laughing the other end of the phone, like, this could only have happened to you. Like, this kind of, have sex one time, get HIV. That is, you know, that is a classic Lee move.
Friends sound like my friends, to be honest.
Well, I think when you have situations like, you know, disabilities and health conditions and things that once they're there, you can't change. The only thing you can do is laugh about them, because if you take them 100% seriously all the time, then you're not going to get anywhere in life. You're going to spend the whole of life being miserable and depressed. So you need to be able to laugh about this.
You
stuff.
Do, don't you? Yeah.
So that kind of made me feel a little bit better. And then when the guy that I need to speak to came after the show and I told him, his reaction was, so I said, so I've just come back from the doctors, and I'm HIV positive. And he went, oh, where did you get that from? And I was like, fucking hell, really? That's the approach you want to take?
Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, well, you're the only person I've slept with literally ever. So you do the maths, mate. And from there, he took a couple of minutes and came back. And we then approached the entire thing together, which was nice. So I went back to his that night just so we had someone in terms of support. We kind of spent the evening talking about things. And then the next day we went to the hospital together so he could get tested and confirmed, which confirmed that he was HIV positive as well. Get our initial kind of blood results with how much of the virus was in our blood and how long before they thought they need to put us on medication. Because essentially, when you get your HIV diagnosis, what they do is they look at your viral load.
Mm-hmm.
And they wait until your viral load hits a certain point before they put you on medication. Because once you're on medication, you're on medication forever. You can't stop it.
You can't.
That was so going through that process with someone the following day was an absolute godsend. I don't know how I would have felt if I'd have been on my own, and anyone that's had to go through that on their own, like, Jesus Christ, I commend you, because that it was a horrible, horrible time, like really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And since then, me and him have obviously remained friends. He's not local to the Leicester area. He kind of travels around for work. And so he just... we see each other about once a year and touch base on how things are with health and stuff, and he doesn't really tell many people about his health condition either. I think he keeps it very close to himself. And for the most part I follow suit. It's something that over the last 10 years I'm getting more and more comfortable kind of talking about with people, but there's an obligation that you have, and this is something that makes, I think, HIV a little bit different from some other health conditions, is if you want to get sexually intimate with someone, you kind of need to tell them regardless, you know.
Yeah.
Like, even if you were insistent on using a condom every time, you still need to tell them just in case, you know, just in case something happens, or just in case they decide that they're going to presume you're clean. And, you know, you've got to have that. And I hate that phrase, clean. It's just what's used in the gay world, but it's gross and it needs to not exist anymore.
Yeah.
It means that any time that I went on a date with someone, you know, as soon I had to gauge when is the appropriate time to bring this up. And sometimes I got that wrong and I brought it up too early. And sometimes I got it wrong and I brought it up too late. And the response completely varies from different guys as well. I'm very, very fortunate that kind of my last two boyfriends have been really, really smart, you know, and able to process that really well. But even then, like, I've got my current boyfriend and my last boyfriend, he took a bit of time to process it. And I think that was because we'd met up on an app, we'd gone to a pub, you know, we'd had some food, we'd had some drinks, we got on really, really well, we'd gone back to his, we were watching a Netflix show, we were laughing at the same things, it was all going really, really well. And then things started to get a little bit physical, and then I was like, I need to tell you this. And then the response was, I knew everything was too perfect. And then I'm like, that's a smear. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's full on a oof. And I appreciate that he was being honest and he was telling me his interpretation, you know? So I'm not offended by the way that that went down at all. I'm just thinking about the impact that then
it
has.
It's kind of a mood killer, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It was.
And it's not re-traumatizing, but it's a bit salt in the wound, isn't it? It's a bit, you know, this is already something that you're not, it's not like you're going, hey, I've got great news.
Hi!
It's already something that you're kind of carrying around, that you're anxious about sharing with, you're anxious about the impact it's going to have on them and you and, you know, your health, never mind your kind of intimacy and relationship. So then kind of, it's not to be rejected because of it, because it doesn't sound like an outright rejection, but it is a,
for them to go, oh, hang on, wait a minute, like you know, I was really hot on you and now I'm blowing a little bit cold.
Exactly, and that's 100% how it was. And it sucks. And then so over kind of the next few days, because obviously that was our first date, you know, we were speaking a lot, and then and he was being honest, and he'd reached out to some of his friends and been like, I met this really awesome guy, but he's got HIV. What do I do? What do I do? He'd spoken to his, you know, his family, and, you know, they didn't know me. So again, I'm not taking this as an attack on me. I'm taking it as people's interpretation of HIV as a virus, you know? But everyone basically said to him, stay the fuck away, you know, like clear out. And that didn't happen, thankfully, because we talked it through. But you know, that is people's interpretation is you don't want to get involved in that. It's too complex, you know, fail.
And I think as well, you know, there's a lot of similarities there with being disabled and dating when you're disabled. For me, I'm a visually disabled, you know, I'm visibly disabled. And you know, when I'm on dating apps and things like that, I've now decided that I have to have like a mix of photographs so they can see straight away in my wheelchair, because it clears out, like, you know, time wasters from the people that are actually like, okay, we can perhaps give this a go. But even then, like, you feel like you have to mention, oh, by the way, I'm in a wheelchair. And then you get like really intrusive questions that you think, I've literally started talking to you 5 minutes ago, and now you're asking me whether I can have sex, like, what is wrong with you? Or you get people who just disappear, they unmatch you and they disappear. And it's the same thing, like, I'm not ashamed of my disability. I know what I've got and the barriers we'd have to face together, but I don't need reminding about what's quote unquote wrong with me. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's a very,
I think, of the two things that you've just sort of talked about there, Lucy, I think actually the intrusive questions are shit because they're never delivered in a sensitive way.
No.
But I can understand that if there is somebody out there who has never, you know, had a friend or a partner with a wheelchair, that they may have questions. And if they want to continue talking to you and they like you, that there are going to be questions they need to ask. It's about how they deliver it. Mm-hmm. I think the disappearing, you know, which is exactly what, you know, this guy's friends and families were saying to us, get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
That's so offensive because it's just like, this is not worth even asking questions about. Just get out.
It's a bit like, oh, you're disgusting. I wouldn't want to be seen with you. Like, I don't want to be seen with somebody in a wheelchair looking like a carer. How, you know, that's not what I want. And the reality of it is they're not my carer. Do you know what I mean? That you know, that's not what they're there for. They're not to like help me take my coat off when I arrive at a restaurant. But you know, it's that kind of thing that if you like somebody, you'd do it anyway, wouldn't you? Without even questioning, like, do you want to hand taking your coat off? It's like that. But it's that kind of like, oh no, I'm not talking to you. That's weird.
And I think with
heartbreaking,
with the, you know, HIV and the way that people kind of still believe that it impacts, you know, how the stigma and things like that not wanting to be involved with someone, it's the this isn't worth it for me. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's, I mean, it's seeing the illness, isn't it? It's seeing the disability mm-hmm. and not seeing the person that's on the other yeah, side of it.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it is, but it's also, it's seeing the illness of 30 years ago. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's, that's what it's, because, so the deal with HIV is once they then do put you on medication, so obviously you're contagious. So the difference, I guess, and this isn't a trumping contest, it's just an additional thing. The difference yeah. with kind of between HIV and a disability here is that, you know, if I didn't tell someone and I slept with them and then all exactly. of a sudden they've got that same condition, do you know what yeah. I mean? It's like being yeah. able to pass your disability on. And I think anyone that's got a health condition or a disability, if you thought that that was a very real risk, like my yeah. biggest fear is passing HIV on to someone else. That's my biggest fear, without a shadow of a doubt, because I wouldn't want to inflict that on anyone.
That is the reason I'm adopting, because my
absolutely is, absolutely
you know, and I'm just like, as much as I know that you can live a full life and be very happy and all of this with a visual impairment, I don't want to put my children through the difficulties yeah. and the, you know, the,
you've lived it firsthand, haven't you, Alice? It's like exactly. If I knew that I could pass cerebral palsy on, I don't think I would, you know, do that to my child either, because it's, you know, whilst we sit here and say, oh, it's, you know, it's just part of life, we get on with it. It is, there is also a hell of a lot of shit to deal with.
And I think,
shitty, you know,
I do want to caveat, you know, there are absolutely people out there with exactly. hereditary conditions who do make the choice, who, you know, and I have a friend who gave the argument to me of, well, who out there is better to parent a disabled child than a disabled parent? And I get that. I yeah. do. Absolutely. Yeah. But for me personally, it's the guilt. Every yeah. time my blind child would come home from school and they'd been bullied, I yeah. would just, I'd be overwhelmed by the guilt, because that's my eye condition that I passed on. And yeah. I imagine it's similar for you, Lee, is that every time you saw your partner was ill, you saw your partner was afraid, mm-hmm. you'd think that's because of, you know, the condition that I passed on to them.
Yeah. I mean, and it would be if medicine hadn't come on the way that it has and has yeah. so much now. And then, yes, you know, so it gets to the point now where once you're then on tablets and your viral load starts coming down, it never disappears completely. But once it gets below a certain level, you're then what's called, clinically, it's called undetectable. And it means that you cannot pass HIV on, as long as you keep taking your medication and you keep that viral load down. Now, if I was to stop taking my medication, that viral load will creep back up and I would become infectious again. So it's just about making sure that I'm super strict on my meds, which I am. And that's great. But again, it takes away an element of freedom, because that's my biggest fear. It means that I can't just go out one night and then not come home. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't go to a mate's house and fall asleep on the couch and not go home until the morning, because then I've missed taking one dose. Now, a doctor would say to you, well, it doesn't matter that you've missed one dose. But to me, that matters, because, you yeah. know, it's almost like I'm not taking my condition seriously. I'm not taking the risk seriously. I'm not taking X, Y, Z. And so there's an element of responsibility that comes with an HIV diagnosis that's really, really important. And some people, I don't know if you've watched It's a Sin, but you know, there's an element where some people just throw care to the wind, and
yeah.
that can be a fight or flight response, you know. Mm. And so, that can be really dangerous.
So when you take your meds, Lee, is mm-hmm. it like the same time every day on the dot? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't need to be on the dot, so it's not the same time for me. So my meds, so it used to be tablets for HIV used to be quite a complicated concoction of tablets. Mm-hmm. And now there are options available where it's one tablet that has a variety of different tablets all smushed into it, basically.
Yeah.
So I was on that from, I was on one tablet from 2012 through to, I think, last year. And now they've changed it for another one tablet. And the main side effect of that tablet is it kind of makes you a bit high for a little while, which is lovely if you like that.
yeah, but that's what you're into. Crack on.
Yeah, but I am not into that. So I take the tablet before I go to bed and then basically sleep through the trip is kind of what happens. But that leads to some really fucked up dreams and it makes getting up in the morning incredibly difficult, because every single morning is essentially a come down. and so and that's lasting, you know. So as much as You get that. You'll even lead a normal life. It won't even be like you realize, well, actually, I've got to make sure I'm home every night. And every single fucking morning is an absolute bitch of a struggle. Now, I struggled getting up anyway. And this definitely made it worse. Now, the tablets they've changed me to has made it a little bit easier. There is, you know, there's less of that side effect. And it doesn't mean getting up in the mornings is a little bit simpler. But it's still there. You know, there's still that side effect that is a pain in the ass. And there's been a couple of times where I have missed the dose of the previous drug I was on. And I've taken it in the morning and then had to go through that during the day. And there was one glorious time where I went to a supermarket with my mum. I'd gone to visit my parents, thought I'd forgotten my tablets, panicked, called the hospital. They said, yeah, come along in the morning and pick them up. And then I'd found them in my bag the next morning before going to the hospital. So I took one then to try and kind of compensate for the dose I'd missed. And we went to the supermarket. And while we were in the supermarket, these tablets kicked in. And I remember having a 20-minute conversation, stood in front of the sausages with some woman. And I remember picking up a cheese grater. It was an amazing cheese grater. It had like six sides. It was one of these like giant cheese graters. You might have seen them before. But I'd never seen a cheese grater that was this big before. So I was just walking around the supermarket showing everyone this cheese grater. It was the best thing. And then, you know, about 3 hours later, Mum's like, are you all right now? And I'm like, yeah, that was horrible. I don't want that to happen ever again. No. So yeah. I just don't like it. I don't like that feeling of not being in control.
No.
I think as well, just something you mentioned earlier that I thought about, going back to kind of talking about dating profiles and stuff. Something they've put on Grindr now is the ability to put your HIV status, which I think is a bit of a double-edged sword. And so a question that I've kind of got for you, Lucy, is, you know, when you said about you changed around your profile so that you had pictures that made it clear that you had a disability, aside from, you know, people asking for clarification, did that attract any hate? Did anyone come in literally just to throw hatred at the fact that you had a disability?
I can't try to think now. Not really, I don't think. There were some people that were like, oh, I'll race you down the supermarket aisle. I was like, I will beat you. No sweat. Like,
I was gonna say, you got 30 years of practice on.
Yeah, I can get my arms well back behind my wheels. It's like, I'll see you on the other side, mate. But no, not really. The like, if anything, like when I used to just like write it in my bio, that would, so it would take effort for people to find it, go, okay, she's in a wheelchair, I would often get I can remember one guy. He said, this was years ago, he said to me, first of all, like when I got to the point, when I told him, like, oh, by the way, I'm in a wheelchair, he kind of said like, oh, what is it you've got? Which is a lovely turn of phrase. Mm-hmm. And I said, cerebral palsy. And he said, oh, okay, what happened? Another lovely turn of phrase. So I said, nothing exciting. I basically was born too early, had a lack of oxygen, and here we are. Like, I wasn't, my legs weren't bitten off by a shark or anything. And he said, oh, you should sue the hospital. And I was like, why would, this was like in 1987. Like, I'm like, why would I do that? And he said, oh yeah, you should definitely see the hospital. I was like, well, I'm not, but thank you for the legal advice. And then he said, because I didn't really put any, at that time in the early days, I didn't really put my wheelchair on the profile because I thought, I don't want to put people off, like, because they see the chair and they think that's all I am and I'm not. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really use any photos of me in my chair at that time. And he said, oh, I think you're trying to trick people. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? He was like, well, I can't see you in a wheelchair. How do I know you're lying? I was like, why would I lie about being in a wheelchair? Of all the things I could lie about, why would I lie? So actually, it was actually the other way around. The fact that if I didn't show my wheelchair, I felt like, so this, like I've basically had two rounds of online dating. The second round, I decided to mix it up a bit because then nobody could accuse me of lying or hiding things. And
I do think though that like, outside of your online dating experience, Lucy, I mean, it's not something I've experienced, but you have just had people out the blue being like, you know, look at you, you're in a wheelchair, it's fucking disgusting. I mean, that is definitely something that by being out there openly disabled on the internet, people will just throw hate at you for the sheer fact that you exist.
I mean, we've been on the news for our podcast, haven't we, Alice? And, for me, there was always this line of, oh, God, are we going to get a load of abuse because we're two disabled women on the news who are just pissing about with a podcast, really? Technical term. And we haven't had that. But I've had other experiences where I've done media interviews and stuff, and they've said, oh, like, this will go out online and be prepared for a bit of backlash because, you know, the things I say aren't necessarily what everybody else believes. And, you know, people think you can't have different opinions on the internet. And I sort of turned around to this producer and I was like, listen, I am a disabled woman on Twitter. Like, I've heard it all. I've had all sorts of abuse. You do kind of get a bit of a thick skin to it, really. But there is something about online dating that is quite a bit more like near the knuckle when it comes to like dealing with people being a bit of an asshole about things or just unmatching without even really saying anything. When they've scrolled through the profile and go, oh shit, no. Like,
yeah,
no.
It's a lot more personal, isn't it? You know, like when you're just online on media, people see you as, oh, you're the girl with a disability. But when you're on, you know, when you're on a dating site, you're putting yourself out there. And so when people are then just responding to a disability, that is personal then, you know. And that's why the only reason I asked is because I didn't put my HIV status on my profile. You know, I like being in control of when I release that information. And there was a fear that if I did, I was going to get some people just messaging me straight off and being like, oh, you're disgusting. And some people that were going to just completely block me straight off because they, you know, that approach of, oh, I don't want to get involved with that, or and not take the time to know me first. Because, you know, if you think about my ex-boyfriend, the whole reason we got together is, even despite his friends and family saying, you don't want to get involved in that, was that we'd had that date first, and he thought that the rest of me was worth that thing. And, you know, I need to play to my strengths. So
yeah, exactly.
I can't put that information there. But at the same time, when you said about, you know, putting pictures of you, you know, and your wheelchair on the dating thing, I was like, well, actually, that would take that conversation away from me needing to do it. So it's a double-edged sword, I think.
Oh, well, it was actually, I was talking to Alice about this when I sort of said, like, I've joined online dating, and she gave me advice, and she said, look, Luce, just put your pictures, like, mix them in a bit. So it's not all you are. But it's something that needs to be considered, because you don't want time wasters. You don't want to get to know somebody really who's really nice, and then they find out you're in a wheelchair and it's all gone to crap anyway. And at the same time, she said, if they don't like your wheelchair and you're getting like abuse, now is your perfect opportunity to not have to be that nice Lucy that everybody knows. You could just tell them to fuck off. So that's what I've been doing. Thank you, Alice.
I would say do take my online dating advice with a pinch of salt.
Now you tell me.
I met my husband in my best friend's living room.
Okay.
So it was like the joke we tell is that out of our sort of most of my friends, in a weird sort of way, their partners are my husband's friends. So I met my husband because my best friend is with one of his oldest friends.
Right.
So, we had this quite large group of us, about 10 or 12 of us. And there was a period of time where he and I were the only single ones in the group. So it just kind of went, yeah, right.
You're here. No,
nearly 12 years on.
It must have worked.
We're both just too lazy to go outside and meet new people.
But I definitely
Which I suppose counts as having something in common.
Yeah. Maybe. I definitely think though, like, as I've got, I think now I'm a little bit older, maybe I'm more comfortable sort of talking about my disability and how it affects me and stuff. So maybe that's an approach. Like, I'm not ashamed of my wheelchair. My wheelchair cost me a lot of money. I want people to look at it. It's beautiful. Like, appreciate it. So, you know, and if they're gonna be an asshole about it straight off the bat, then they're not the right person for me, are they, really? So that's the way I look at it. And it was Alice's advice of just put your foot, and like, you don't have to be a nice person to everybody. Like, to all intents and purposes, these people who message you in the first instance are strangers. Like, just act like they're strangers who give you shit in the supermarket. Yeah. So that's what I do now. Thanks, Al. Thanks, Tilla.
There was a guy that I met on an app, and then I was his house was on my way home from work. So I saw him a few times, and I was at that point I was thinking about becoming a teacher. Mm. And he was a teacher. So there was lots that we could talk about. And it wasn't really a hookup thing. It wasn't like I'd go to his on the way home for a shag. It was like I'd go to his on the way home and maybe we'd have a kiss and a cuddle, but for the most part, we'd probably have just a chat about how we were and then we'd move on. So it was quite nice. But there was one time we were talking, and this was the last time I saw him, unsurprisingly. We were chatting in his living room, and he said, because I'd not told him about my HIV status, because things hadn't progressed to that point where I'd needed to. We were talking, and he was asking about what I look for in a guy. So I was saying things like them being intelligent, having a good sense of humor, blah, 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 blah. And then he said to me, would you ever date a black guy? And I was like, well, yes. What sort of a question is that? and he was like, oh no, I don't think I could. And I legitimately, I was like, why? Like, where does that come from? And he was like, oh, he's like, it's really bad, but I just think they all have HIV. And then I was like, well, I'm out. Like, that's it. I'm done. Like, I can't.
Bye now.
Because there was so much, like, and this guy up until that point had been so lovely to talk to. But then that one opinion, I was like, way to stab me, way to stab the entire race of people.
Yeah.
Like, and, but that perception still stands. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a, I don't know. And that is a real key memory for me in my brain as a real thing that happened.
Yeah.
That is a real thing that people think. Like,
I think as well with the stigma of, like, you saying the stigma of HIV and the, like, the media representation of what age, like, you know, I always remember that, like, I see clips of the Tombstone advert about HIV and the tombstones falling over, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that stigma of HIV is very similar to the kind of stigma that I think people learn about disability from an angle of, oh, they're poor. You know, if we're not Paralympians, we're basically amoebas who are dying. And I am neither of those. Like, I'm not a Paralympian. Like, that's the first question. Do you play any sport? No. Do you? Like, do you? And, you know, they think, oh, the poor people sitting in juggle bottoms with egg dropped down them because they can't feed themselves properly. And it's like, yeah, I have problems. I have problems feeding myself, but that's not because of anything to do. It's just because I'm clumsy and I'm hungry and I want to get it in my face. that's the main reason I drop things down my front. But it's very
makes me think of, I can't remember what the character's name was. I think her name was Lisa off of EastEnders, and her fella, was it Mark, possibly his name was HIV positive. And all I can remember very specifically him saying something like, he's found somebody who's actually willing to have sex with him.
Yeah.
And I was like, I mean, that just says so much about the way that people think about, I mean, the way that we are encouraged ourselves as people with health conditions and disabilities is find someone who's willing to have sex, not wants to, who's like excited about it. Yeah. Someone who could, it's like taking the bins out.
Yeah. You're the only one, you're the bottom of the barrel, but you'll do because I'm desperate. You know, that.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, fine, I'll do it for you. It needs to be done. Yeah. And I think that's kind of it. And I think that as much as I can see with the idea of putting the HIV status up on Grindr, like, There is an element of going kind of good, you know, that's, it's being really open, it's trying to destigmatize, but I would feel really worried that there are going to be, you know, that your connection with people would partly, you'd be kind of, oh, well, I even though this person's a dickhead, I can't let them go because they're willing to date me because they know. Whereas if you take your approach, Lee, of getting to know someone and when the time is right, sharing that information with them, it's like, you know, your ex made the decision based on the connection that you had.
Absolutely.
I mean, and I suppose your way of disclosing that information, Lee, can lead to be it being a little bit painful, where if they turn around and show their true colours, that's like, because I actually really like you and you're an arsehole.
Yeah.
That is something I really struggle with, that if I find out there are, I mean, I've got a horrific story to tell about online dating experiences that are completely knocked my confidence, and I didn't do it again for years because of it. And you just think, oh, I'm not doing that again. Like, it takes a lot to I think pick yourself back up, dust yourself back off and go, okay, we're going to do this again, because you've got to like start right from the beginning of, hi, how are you, knowing what's to come. It's a very brave thing to do. But I mean, if, like, with my disability, if they don't mention my disability when I'm talking to them, I don't necessarily bring it up now, because they can see I'm in a wheelchair. If they've got any questions, they'll ask. But sometimes you can sense it coming. You're like, oh, here it comes. And then after I've told them, it's like a big sigh of relief. And they're still here. They're asking me what my favourite TV show is. That's lovely. But yeah, it's a very brave thing to do, I think. And I think the whole putting your HIV status on online dating, do you think, Lee, that's come from like COVID statuses on dating apps? I don't know.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it's about well, I think with the emergence of the PrEP drug, which is the preventative HIV drug, I think that's helped, because then your PrEP status is there as well if you're negative on PrEP, or so you can put what the deal is there. So I think it was just from kind of, I think it's about trying to destigmatize HIV, but for someone with HIV, that's the idea of putting there, that, you know, because also there's, people are weird,
they are. Yes.
I don't want to yuck anyone's yum, but there are people out there that, you know, are HIV negative and are actively looking for an HIV positive partner. I don't know why. I don't know what that mentality is, but there's something like there. I've seen kind of snapshots on Twitter, because everything's on Twitter, but of people like asking to be posed, you know, asking to be made HIV positive, which blows my mind.
I just don't understand it.
Yeah, in the most negative, and I don't want to be inviting people like that, even if I said, because again, it'd say positive undetectable, so you know, people would know, educated people would know that I wasn't able to pass that on. But I don't want to like have someone come around to me and be like, yo, can you infect me? That's the weirdest fucking thing.
It's a little bit disabled devotee, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, oh, you know, you're disabled and I want to like look at your feet because they don't work.
I want to watch you struggle as you get on the sofa.
And I could understand if HIV was like being bitten by that spider off of Spider-Man, but
that's cool, isn't it?
It's kind of going to make you poorly. Yeah. Like, is that really what you, I can't personally do not, as you say, see what the draw is.
It's not a chicken pox party.
No,
I'll do this once, then you're covered for like the rest of your life. You won't get it again. Like, once you've got it, you've got it. It's like, it's not, you know, let's sit little Johnny down next to, you know, see if he can get chicken pox and get it out of the way while he's five.
Absolutely.
It's weird. So weird.
No, really, weird. Really odd. Really
People odd. Are strange. People are.
So, do you think, Lee, if the thing, you know, the Grindr putting up the HIV status thing is a push to try and destigmatize, I mean, what would you say needs to happen kind of alongside that work? Because I think there is, you know, there's more complexity to those stigmas. And although encouraging people to be open and not ashamed of their label is one thing.
Yeah, I know when I got my diagnosis, the doctor and my mum, actually, because when I had to tell her, and that was, Jesus, that was a whole fucking story. Like, because obviously telling my parents was something that I had to do in case anything went wrong. You know, because I could have kept it a secret. I know that the person that I got diagnosed with, I think his opinion is I don't need to tell my parents. You know, I'm not going to need to tell my parents, because I'll be fine and they never need to know. But again, he's a little bit older than, well, he's a lot older than I was. So his parents are significantly older. But my parents went through that generation, but have still got a lot of their life left. So kind of I had to have that conversation. And when I told my mum, it was like an instant breakdown because the 80s were her time period. That was it. That was when she was a teenager, when she was at her most influential from media and, you know, and that was hard. That was really, really hard. My gran, on the other hand, telling her was brilliant. She literally, I told her, thought she was going to react in a similar way. And she went, well, medicine's come on a long way. I'm sure you'll be fine. And that was it. So telling her
was great. Nice one, granny. Yeah.
Do you want another biscuit? Cup of tea?
Yeah, exactly. But telling mum was, that was a real hard time. And then my sister, who's younger than me, she was in the room with mum at the time, and because mum reacted so badly, my sister reacted really badly, and she didn't even know what HIV was, and she was an absolute mess because of how scared my mum was. It was a real tough moment. But then mum went away and did what mum does, which is a buttload of research. And so what she told me mirrored what the doctor said, which is that the highest increase in HIV cases was actually in straight females, because of the increase of bisexuality, but also dating apps being more like hookup apps, and the amount of straight men that were kind of utilizing those apps for homosexual purposes and then and bringing that back. So there was a huge surge of HIV positive cases in straight females. And actually, I think what needs to happen is it's almost the gayness needs to be taken out of the HIV. Yes. Because we're living in a world now where anybody can most likely will sleep with anyone. Do you know what I mean? And I mean that in the most positive way possible, you know, as a sex forward community now, you know, that's great. But the HIV being the gay disease is still a stigma that's there, you know, it's still a thing that people think of, and we need to get rid of that and look at it as the permanent threat. Even though it's not as threatening as it was, it's still something that sticks with you, and no one wants a permanent blemish. Do you know what I mean? No one.
So do you think we should be pushing for Tinder to have a HIV badge?
Yeah, I think if Grindr should do it, everyone should do it, because just Grindr having it is it still saying this is a thing for gay people? And it's not.
It only affects gay people. Don't worry about straight people. Yeah, I know. Absolutely. Exactly.
So, you know, should it be on? It probably doesn't need to be on lesbian apps. I don't even know how two women would pass HIV on. Like, I don't know how that would work. I don't know. I imagine it would work probably the same way. I don't know enough about the female anatomy. I'm a gay man.
This is not really.
Brilliant, complete segue. Brilliant story. About just before Christmas, I got put in to cover a year 7 science lesson on the female anatomy. Not a fucking
We like, turn your textbooks to page 7 and just read that.
I get there. There's an exercise sheet of all of this terminology that literally anyone should freaking know. And I'm like, I have no idea where any of these on a woman are. Like, none. I have zero experience of this.
Oh, brilliant.
That's brilliant.
In terms of, you know, being a teacher, obviously, you know, you've shared your HIV status within your personal life. I can only imagine that there would be some difficult backlash were you to kind of share that in your professional life. But I do also know that, you know, you've done a lot of work supporting and advocating for some of your LGBTQ students. Mm-hmm. You know, is that something that's kind of come up that you've...
I have thought about disclosing my HIV status so many times. Backstory for kind of the LGBT advocacy is, so as I explained, I kind of grew up in a kind of homophobic household. Now, again, don't get me wrong, my dad doesn't go around beating up gay people. It's just the reaction of, oh, there's two gay people interacting, and his reaction is very visceral and guttural and like, oh, that's disgusting. He would never go up to them and tell them that they're disgusting, but his personal reaction is, that's gross. And as a member of his family, that was the reaction that I would see.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So And when I came out to my, well, I didn't come out to my dad. I called my mum up and I said, hey, mum, I've got a boyfriend now. And she went, okay. And I went, can you tell dad? Thanks, bye.
Pass the message on, will you?
Yeah. And then my dad called me. It took him 2 weeks, but 2 weeks later he called me and he was like, I just wanted to have a chat. I wanted to tell you I still love you. I tell you it's okay. I don't think any less of you, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and my dad's done some really great work in kind of familiarizing himself and making that okay. Do you know what I mean? So he's done the work kind of, but there is that element for me of when I got to teaching, we were taught as teachers, as a batch of teachers, that if you talk a little bit about yourself as a human being and your life, so if if you're married, if you've got kids, if you've got a dog, you know, those little snippets of information the students absolutely love. They latch onto it because they're learning a little bit about you.
They're like peeking in through the window, isn't it, and going, oh, there he is. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's what people say to us about podcasters. They really like apparently our listeners really like to know more about us, so
they just like listening to us gossip, don't they, really?
Absolutely. Like, so I in my spare time that I don't have a lot of, I stream. And it's the same thing. Like when I'm watching other streamers, anytime they give you a little bit of information about their life, you're like, oh, that's great. I'm learning, I'm building this little picture up about you as a person. But when I got in the classroom, I realized, well, I can't do that because, you know, I went through the same as I'm presuming you guys did, an era where LGBT stuff wasn't talking about in schools. You didn't speak about it. Yeah. So I'm like, I can't talk about my kids because I don't have any. I can't talk about my pets because I don't have any. I can't even talk about my relationships because they're gay relationships. Mm-hmm. I have very little in comparison to a straight person to talk about. And then I was like, so what do I do? And I tried to look for help online and there was nothing. And I asked my teacher at the university and he was like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, this is a thing. So, and then what happened was I was teaching a year 8 class. And I have taught in schools of a low socioeconomic area. So they're all kind of mostly working class children, with kind of the same kind of parents as my dad. So those same kind of opinions. And, we were talking about relationships because that's what we do in drama. Sometimes you're talking about human relationships. And one of the students asks if I'm married. Do you have a girlfriend? No. Do you want me to set you up with someone? No. Why not, sir? Because I'm really happy the way that I am. Okay, fine. And then one girl just says to me, so are you gay, sir? And my gut reaction was to go, no. And then we moved on with the lesson and I set them off on a task. And so they're doing something. And that's going around in my brain is, I just lied to a student and I lied about myself. And that sat so horribly with where I am that at the end of the lesson, I held that girl back. I let the rest of the class go. And I was like, I need to apologize because I lied to you. I'm like, I am gay, but I don't really want that to be the way that everyone finds out. Do you know what I mean? And she, now this girl has a reputation for being one of the most high profile and difficult girls in the year group. So I was already like, alarm bells were going and I'm like, I'm fucked. That's it. The end of my career. And she's like, oh no, I get it, sir. I won't tell anyone. Now, inevitably she told some people, but having that conversation with her slowed down the process. And so she was telling people much more slowly and in a one-to-one kind of basis. And by about 3 weeks on, it had gotten out. And it was fine. There was no negative backlash at all while I was at that school. And I left that school then. I think I was at that school for 2 years. Mm-hmm. When I moved to before I moved to the new school, what started happening was I started getting students coming to me and asking LGBT related questions because they had nowhere else to go. Mm. And word had gotten out that, you know, I was gay. Now, again, students would also come to me about other teachers and be like, is this teacher gay? And I'm like, I'm not telling you. I don't know. That's not my business. That's their business, you know. But while I was there, I started doing a master's in teaching and learning. I started to document my experiences as a gay teacher and the impact of me telling my students and how that helped to build relationships. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, there were at least three other teachers at that school that were LGBT. And so as a study for university, I interviewed those students, and I can send you the links for this if you want them, because my paper is available online just to read. But I interviewed them about their approach. Do they tell their students how that makes them feel, why they've made the decision they've made, to try and put together some experiences, much like your podcast, of what LGBT teachers do so that other LGBT teachers can make a decision on how they want to handle it. Because at the end of the day, it's your choice. The same with how we're handling the dating apps. It's our choice how we want to go about doing that.
Yeah.
And there were some teachers that chose, no, that's my personal boundary. I'm not letting the students in on that. And there are others that are like, I'm thinking about it. I've told a couple of select students, blah, blah, blah. When I then moved school, so I've been at my current school now for 4 years, I wanted to hit that straight away as I got there. So within a couple of months, I found the senior team at the school and I said, I want to set up a group for LGBT students or for students that have questions about LGBT issues. Because at the moment, I don't feel like education is hitting it as hard as it should be. So I set that group up and it was very, very well received. Actually, I've taken full responsibility there. I told my students almost kind of within the first couple of weeks. Now, I don't do a, everyone sit down, we're going to talk about how gay I am. We don't have that. but as a drama teacher, when we're looking at relationship stuff, when it comes up or when students, typically it's when students use casual homophobia that I'll flip the coin and I'll be like, well, hang on, because you're in my classroom and I'm a gay man and you've just described so-and-so as gay as an insult, which doesn't make me feel good. And so then we have that and, oh, you're gay, sir. And then we have that conversation. And it kind of, it breeds that kind of, that environment of honesty and also safety for the students because they know that I've been vulnerable with them and so they can be vulnerable with me. So as a teaching mechanism, that works really well. And a student came up to me and was like, sir, I feel like we need an LGBT group. And I was like, yes, okay, fine, I'll do it. And so that was kind of where that came from.
Was that an LGBT student?
It was an LGBT student, yes. So I took it to SLT and SLT's response was really interesting, something I'd not considered before, which is they said, yes, do that. It's something that we've identified that we need, but we can't just ask someone to set it up. We can't go to an LGBT teacher and go, you're gay, you do this? So they can't do that. And at the same time, you know, teacher sexuality isn't really anything to do with the senior management team. That doesn't matter. So they were like, and if a straight teacher set it up, you'd have the same thing like we talked about the doctor at the start, where the kids are like, well, we feel gay, but you're not. So thanks for trying to help us. But at the same time, there isn't that level of similarity there. I kind of established that and set it up, and it's been going from strength to strength. The government itself has kind of put a twist on education over the last kind of couple of years with a big focus on LGBT inclusion and making sure that's included and being taught about in the curriculum. So a complete flip from 30 years ago, where now actually they're saying we need to talk about this because the kids were learning too much too fast because they were going onto the internet themselves because they weren't getting the information from schools. So again, you know, the students are still encouraged to do that, but I'm there to say, if you see something and you're confused about it, come and ask me. And, you know, and I'll have no filter. I'll have no filter. Because if they've seen something, they've already seen it and that needs to be tackled. I can't then put up a professional boundary and be like, oh, I'm not going to talk to you about fisting because you've seen something online. Like, if they ask me a question about that because they've seen it, they need to have that information.
Exactly,
You know,
because the worst thing they can do is learn from fucking YouTube or pornography.
Exactly. And there are still a lot of teachers that alienates, a lot of teachers that would think that that's inappropriate, you know. But if it's always student-led conversation, as long as the student brings it to me, I'll talk about it.
Yeah, you're not openly going to go up to somebody.
I'm not. Jesus.
I'm not talking about fisting or anything else. You've got to wait for them to go, okay.
I think it must be so hard to be, you know, with any job, it's difficult to separate who you are from what you do. You know, Lucy works in marketing and there's an element of the way that she works as in marketing is driven by who she is and her personality. I think as an educator, it must be so difficult not to bring your personal prejudices and stuff into the classroom.
Absolutely.
But it is so important that you don't, because then you're, I mean, you're fucking up an entire generation.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that as a drama teacher, there's a little bit of flexibility there. But again, you do need to be careful, because a lot of drama is about kind of putting forward opinions through performance. And so actually there is a time where I can put opinions forward, and there's times where I put forward opinions that aren't my own. But I always prefix them with, this is just my opinion. I'm not teaching you this as fact. And I make it so explicit. And sometimes, you know, when a student puts forward their opinion, I'll be like, oh, that's a great opinion. The counter opinion might be this, or this. What would you say to me if I was to say this, you know? And I think I mix it up so much that the students don't know what's my opinion and what's a fabricated opinion that I'm creating for drama. And so there is an element of that. But sometimes it's interesting just to kind of get the opinions in the room as well, because you have to at least make out like you're sharing your opinion so that the students feel comfortable sharing their opinion. And that's, I think, a problem with today's student culture, is a lot of students don't feel like they can share their opinion, because they don't see anyone, they don't see teachers sharing their opinion, because you're not allowed to. So it's about kind of building a facade for how do you share an opinion, so the students share opinions, without actually sharing an opinion.
And I think also doing, you know, what you did there, kind of challenging and countering that, it made me think of, in my new job, I've started doing this, it's health awareness raising for young people with LD and autism. And in our very first session, we do a, we call it Healthy Celebs. And we basically bring up pictures of celebrities who are known to have or have had health conditions.
Sorry, I thought you said celeb. I was like, what's a celeb? Can somebody tell me what a celeb is?
Celebs.
I was like, celeb something. Have I missed something? Sorry. Carry on.
And one of the things we did was we put up a picture of Chadwick Boseman. And I said, does everybody know who this is? And everybody were like, oh, it's Black Panther. And I was like, yes, brilliant. And I said, and does everybody know, you know, what happened to him? And they, everybody said he died, he had cancer. And I said, does anybody know what kind of cancer he had? And immediately everybody went, oh, it was probably lung cancer from smoking weed, because he's a young black man.
Wow.
Oh my
and
God.
I turned around and I said, he had bowel cancer.
Yeah.
He had really aggressive bowel cancer that is really hard to detect. And so he died very quickly. And it was just really, you know, and I just used that as an opportunity to say to people, why do you think that was what you're, you know, immediately what you came to? I did then later present them with Snoop Dogg and said, and what do you know, when we think about health conditions, what do people's immediate thoughts about Snoop Dogg? And they were like, getting high as a fucking kite. And I was like, I mean, yes, correct. That is correct. Very much what he is known for. But yeah, it's I think it's that is probably one of, I think, what's the kind of the real joys of being a teacher. I don't class myself as a teacher. I do not have those skills, really. I am a dabbler with too much responsibility.
Proper CV title, that, isn't it?
So I think it's, and I think, you know, one of the things, again, in terms of teaching is, it is that kind of, you do have a responsibility to encourage young people to start challenging things and thinking for themselves. And I think in by being open about your sexuality, and also, you know, if you were ever in a position where you felt able to be open about your HIV status, you know, for a lot of young people, that would really challenge their perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, it's one of my favourite things about being an advocate and somebody who's willing to talk about my experiences to people. I'll talk to anybody who is interested in my experiences, because I think every little helps. Do you know what I mean?
I agree.
So I get a lot of students who are doing dissertations on the last interview I did was about home working during the pandemic and how it helped me as a disabled person, and being able to have that one-on-one time with them so that they actively want to hear my opinion. And I always have like a little bit of time afterwards where I'm like, do you have any questions? And I say to them, like, it doesn't really matter if you think it is a stupid question. I will answer it because I have heard all of the stupid questions under the sun. Nothing surprises me anymore. And I think they get a lot out of it because of my willing to be open about it. I don't particularly, and this is again through me and Alice, I don't particularly do the thing where somebody goes, what's wrong with you then in the street? And I tell them. I used to. And then I thought, Alice went, why are you doing that? There's no need to do that. Like, they're a stranger. But if they actively ask and say, because I'm doing a dissertation on XYZ, then I will tell them. Mm. And it is one of, because I think it really like gives me hope for the future when you are talking to these people who actively want these conversations.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me think, well, it's not all bad, is it, really? You know, there are people out there wanting to understand and help, you know, a little bit. Yeah, I think that approach, your approach, Lee, is the way it should be, really, in this day and age.
Thanks. You know? It's nice to hear welcome. That.
You're very welcome.
It's been a real joy to talk to you, Lee. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on with us while you were here?
I don't know. I think one other thing that I've maybe not mentioned that I do mention quite a lot to people when I'm talking about this is the change that my diagnosis had on my personality. Mm-hmm. So after my diagnosis for maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, I was pretty down, understandably. Mm-hmm. But then it was like, Lucy, you just mentioned a light bulb moment, and it was like that. There was a moment where it kind of kicked in and I went, well, I don't know. You know, life is a complete surprise after surprise after surprise. And so that means, why should I be sat around being fucking miserable? And so from that moment, I've been a much more positive person. I've taken a lot of kind of big blows in a less dramatic way, you know. So if someone is going to say something that's quite offensive, I will shrug it off a little bit more and be like, I haven't got time to waste with this one person that's offensive. Yeah. I'm going to go and deal with something better, you know? It almost promoted me to do more stuff, you know? And I'm really grateful that my brain managed to do that flip, because I think it could have been very easy to have been really sad and woe is me for the entirety of my life. But actually that flip in positivity and that flip in literally anything could happen. Let's just do everything that we can, I think, has been really beneficial for me. And has kind of meant that my life's been on a real upward trajectory since then, which has been really nice.
That's so great to hear.
And really, I think that resonates quite a lot with an episode that's we sort of did in sort of preempting this Pride series, where Fiona talked about a lot of newly disabled people experiencing that very, this is the end of my life, everything is terrible, and actually the not engaging with the, you know, those who have had disabilities and chronic illnesses and stuff for on the more long term, and in seeing that
The disabled joy,
that you can just get on with shit. Like, that you can just go, like, this is my life, and I could sit here and be miserable. And yes, sometimes things are hard, but going, you know, I don't have time to deal with the shit because there's other stuff I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I especially like the idea of kind of going, it's almost rising, you know, it lowers your tolerance for bullshit, and I think helps you rise above the kind of stuff that is really, really hard. There is an element of going, well, I've had the shit kicked out of me once already, and I got through it. Like, I can get through this.
I think you realize the power that you have as a human being to choose. Like, if you receive some bad news about a health condition or a disability, and you know, you need time to process, so you're going to have time where you're sad, but it's when your brain says, actually, the disability or the health condition isn't what's ruining my life right now. What's ruining my life is the way I'm reacting to the fact that that exists.
Yeah.
And as soon as you've got that, it's so empowering to go, so I'm just going to not care. And then that's it. Like, all of a sudden, your life quality has improved tenfold because you've gone, actually, I'm taking control of this. Yeah. I control the condition doesn't control me.
Yeah. In fact, more often than not, rather than getting sad about my disability, I tend to get angry about stuff. And like my friends and I always joke that whenever something horrible or unjust happens to me, I happen to just get on Twitter, call a press conference, get the press involved, and they will sort it out. It's like, this is not on. Can somebody listen to me, please? And I won't let it go either, because I get so irate and so angry that, like, steps and stairs and, you know, this is not right. You're being ableist.
I think that's the difference as well. I think that difference between sadness and anger is really important, because I think sadness is you reacting to the potential of things that you might not be able to do or the things you've lost. Whereas anger is reacting in the now to something that is currently happening and something that is, as you put it, unjust or unfair or, you know, just unreasonable for the sake of being unreasonable and should be fucking fixed, you know. And I think that's more justified.
I told Alice the other day that I'd had a dream that she basically said, you've got far too much going on that's upsetting us. We're just going to call the press conference, sort this out. And I turned up wearing a fur coat and big sunglasses. And she was like, I'm going to read a statement on behalf of Lucy. And I just didn't say anything. I was like, I'm not speaking to the press. She was like, you'd stop eating cheese before bed. Like, I was just sort of sat there with my lipstick on, like, I'm not speaking to anybody. Alice, do it for me.
Proper like Jackie O style diva.
Yeah, proper. Yeah. So I get angry more than sad.
Lee, it's been so great to have you on. Thank you so much. Do you want to tell people where they can find you on the internet if you want people to find you on the internet?
I don't mind people finding me on the internet. The easiest way to get hold of me is probably through Twitter, where I am Leedipus. That's LEEDIPUS. Like I say, I'm a streamer in my spare time, so a lot of my streaming stuff gets put on there, but also things about the stuff that I'm doing in education get put on there as well. Because I like to keep everything together, because I am one person and I don't like to split that into a kajillion different accounts. That's all there. You can DM me through that and I'll give you an email address if you wanted to contact me about something a little bit more kind of detailed. That's fine by me.
If you give us all the links to that, Lee, we can stick it in the show notes for this episode.
Lovely.
Find you there. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time today. It's been really interesting to talk to you. I could quite easily sit in the pub and talk to you for hours on end, so should we sort that out?
Yeah, let's do that. Sorry, let's do that. I didn't want to come across like me being like, oh no, she wants to talk to me, back out.
No, go away, I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Which way do I swipe to say no?
Get away from me.
And on that note, guys, we'll see you next time. Hopefully you're not swiping to get away from us.
No, let's hope not.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to The Label Podcast. If you like the show, you can rate, review and subscribe. And you can follow us on social media at Labeled Pod.
This episode was edited by Adam Hall. Our music was by Maisie Crunden, and we'd like to thank the rest of the team involved.